From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA executive producer Steve Reddish. Welcome, Anita and Steve.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Well, here are the issues. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates by 0.75 percentage point to help curb soaring inflation as lawmakers predict continued supply shortages and a possible recession. President Biden sounded upbeat notes that a recession can be avoided during a midterm election year, saying the employment picture is so strong that it can weather rising prices and the Fed's aggressive efforts to cool a too-hot economy. Former President Donald Trump returned to Washington, D.C. for the first time since he departed the White House under a cloud of controversy, teasing out a vision for a Republican-controlled government as he nears a decision on running for president again in 2024. In an NBC News interview, Attorney General Merrick Garland suggested that the federal criminal investigation of the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol building has extended far beyond the rioters, leaving Trump's viability as a leader of the GOP in question. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited Africa. The tour aimed to strengthen Moscow's ties with a continent that has refused to join Western condemnation and sanctions over Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And a new health threat has emerged after the WHO chief declared monkeypox a public health emergency. The news comes as President Biden has just recovered from COVID-19. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Anita, what is the White House reaction to the Federal Reserve raising interest rates again, this time 0.75 percentage point?
I just want to widen this context and just talk about what the White House is saying about this strange economic position we find ourselves in. Of course, they've noted that the Fed is independent. You know, they don't tell the Fed what to do. But we are seeing two consecutive quarters of contraction in the economy, which is the impetus that made the Fed do this. And the White House is painting a much rosier picture of what is happening to the American economy than a lot of critics are painting. Two consecutive quarters of contraction is the technical definition, some people argue, for a recession. And the White House is pushing back and saying, no, we have good employment figures, we have good investment figures, we have good consumer spending figures. This is not a recession. And so the Fed pulling on the brakes and increasing the interest rate is definitely an indication that they're trying to curb spending. But the White House is saying things are better than they look.
Using the word recession is very politically charged. As the country moves toward the November midterm elections, if there is a recession declared, it's going to certainly fuel the hopes and the campaigning by Republicans against Democrats, against President Biden for creating a recession that is in question as to whether it really is a recession. So no matter whether the economic times that we're living in is declared a recession or not, the politics of the economy is certainly going to be a key point in the coming November elections. And Republicans are already out there using the economy as a political point in trying to win the various races that are up for grabs in Congress.
As well they should, because this is easy, low-hanging fruit. I mean, I think it's fair to say nobody anywhere in the world enjoys going to the grocery store and having to spend more of their hard-earned money. And this is, you know, experience that Americans, all of us, every single one of us is going through, having to spend more for fuel, having to spend more for food. This is just universally a problem, I think, is fair to say. And so it would make sense that whoever is not in power is going to capitalize on that politically. And this is, I think, the thing that the Biden administration does understand, but is wrestling with. However we describe this thing, at the end of the day, the average American is sitting at home looking at their grocery store receipts and saying, this isn't right. This isn't okay. They're looking to somebody to fix this. And that is the problem that's in the lap of the Biden administration.
Yes, absolutely. And you all have brought out really good points on this, because the economy is the top issue for voters.
Democrats are going to use other issues such as the January 6th hearings, the Supreme Court's reversal of the abortion ruling, also paint Republicans and the Supreme Court as endangering further rights that Americans have already enjoyed, such as same-sex marriage, such as contraception. So Democrats are really trying to find those issues that poke people a little bit deeper than the economy as a way to get voters out to the polls. It's going to be an interesting election as far as how many people will turn out. Both sides, Republicans and Democrats, have issues that they believe will get their voters out to the polls, whether the economy or whether democracy and democratic process wins the day as far as the issues are concerned. We'll have to wait until November. But those are the two main issues that both sides are going to try and get people out to vote for.
We'll just have to see where voters are going to be in the few months ahead. In our next topic, former President Trump's appearance in Washington was billed as a policy-focused speech to cap off a two-day summit hosted by the America First Policy Institute, a think tank founded by former Trump administration officials. The speech was well-received as Trump spoke to a friendly crowd of GOP lawmakers and former administration officials. Your thoughts on his visit and his possible run for president?
So I was actually there in the room as Trump spoke for 90 minutes, and it was an electric atmosphere. This is definitely being seen by the Trump camp as his triumphant return to Washington as some sort of validation. We were about a mile from the White House. All of these little things are significant. As you mentioned, he hit a lot of points. I think most importantly, he repeated his claim that he won the 2020 election, which, as we know, is the foundation of the January 6th insurrection attempt. This claim, this incorrect claim that he was the actual rightful winner in that poll. And it is certainly notable that he is still bringing this up more than 18 months later and maintaining this. It can only be really called a fiction because, as we noted, the 62 lawsuits that his camp filed were almost all rejected. Election officials across the United States at local and federal levels said this was one of the most secure elections that has ever been held in the United States. The evidence is against him in that claim, and it cannot be stressed enough that that is an erroneous, factually lacking claim that he won the election. But he is still making this claim. And that is going to be possibly the driving force behind his, if he does launch a campaign, if he does run for president, behind his campaign and behind his voters. They are motivated by grievance. They are motivated by anger. This is the crowd that I saw. This is the language that was coming out of Donald Trump. And now he has a bit of policy muscle behind it. This policy institute that his supporters, that his close cabinet officials, his crew have founded, has worked out all of the policy. And he aired some of these policy ideas during his 90-minute speech. And it painted a picture of a locked down America where law and order, in his words, were the priority. And what he means by that is giving police less oversight, hiring more police. He said, notably, a squad car on every corner. And this is a striking vision of America that he presented.
Also presenting rounding up the homeless and putting them in camps and death penalties for drug dealers. It's all this kind of law and order type of America, which somewhat contrasts, especially since the former president is the target of an investigation in which he is alleged to have illegally tried to hijack the election and reverse the election. It's a very stark image that the former president is trying to portray in his bid to retake power and try to rally Republicans around his message of law and order. While he was here in town in Washington, his vice president was also in town trying to make his own way and lay out his vision for the future, which is, let's not look back, let's look forward. While Mike Pence is still trying to take credit for whatever accomplishments the Trump administration made, he is trying to rally Republicans around the idea of let's look forward to where the Republican Party can go in the future.
About that, that is an interesting, like, expansive dodge, isn't it, to the events of January 6th, where Mike Pence's life was directly under threat, where these insurrectionists raised a gallows at the Capitol looking for Mike Pence, saying that they were going to hang Mike Pence. And as we now know from the January 6th hearing, President Trump did not move significantly to stop that. I mean, I just think Pence is trying to position himself as an alternative to Trump, obviously. And he's trying to reach the one thing that America needs right now, which is healing.
And Pence is trying to find that pathway and try to bring together the anti-Trump forces that remains within the Republican Party. Recent polls show that more Republicans believe that former President Trump should be charged with a crime for the events of January 6th than previously. However, it is still not the majority of the Republican Party, for sure. The majority of Republicans still back former President Trump. But that gap between Pence and Trump is widening. And Pence seems to believe that the more that he can continue to drive forward, in some cases, both he and the former president are selecting and endorsing different candidates for the same job in various different Republican primaries as we move forward. We'll see which one of those two are able to accumulate more political power, more political chits, as you might say, from individuals as far as their ability to be able to bring in votes.
Attorney General Merrick Garland told NBC's Lester Holt that the Justice Department and the House Select Committee are conducting wide-ranging investigations regarding the attack on the Capitol. This was during a television interview. From Garland's perspective, the thought that Trump could be a presidential candidate would not affect their investigation. But how will these investigations affect Trump, whether he runs for president or not?
The attorney general certainly is feeling some of the pressure among Democrats that the Justice Department is not moving fast enough. The country is watching these January 6th hearings from Congress, and they're seeing Congress lay out what appears to be a very cogent argument that former President Trump was at the center of all of these different efforts to overturn the election, from trying to persuade state officials to find votes, as the phone call to the Georgia Secretary of State indicates, to summoning a mob to attack Capitol Hill, to various other efforts that has been uncovered in trying to overturn the election. So Garland, the attorney general, is under a lot of pressure to move forward, and Garland is trying to execute whatever investigation is being done in a methodical, transparent way that will stand up to various different scrutiny, because if you're going to charge the former president of the United States, who may run for president again, you're going to charge him with a crime, you better have an airtight case, because if you miss, then that really opens a lot of doors to questions about whether or not anybody in the United States is above the law. And Garland really has a lot of pressure on various different sides to make sure that whatever investigation is done in a way that is airtight and will stand up to scrutiny with the American people. And two former aides of Vice President Pence, his former chief of staff and his former lead attorney, word that those two people have testified before a grand jury investigating the January 6th attack is giving Democrats and others hope that the Justice Department is moving forward in a pace that will produce some sort of decision whether to indict the former president in a time that Democrats hope would be advantageous for the November midterm elections.
And we will have to see how this all pans out as November is quickly approaching. Well, it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, Russia's foreign minister hopes to strengthen ties with Africa. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voaafrica.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA executive producer Steve Reddish. Well, Anita, during Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov's tour of four African countries, he met with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, who said he saw no reason to criticize Moscow over the invasion of Ukraine. And Uganda was among 17 African nations that abstained in a March vote on a United Nations resolution condemning the Russian invasion. Will Africa's neutral position on Russia's invasion, will that benefit the continent?
That's a really interesting question. If you look at somebody like Yoweri Museveni, who's been in power since 1986 and is now pushing his son to be his heir apparent in Uganda. So it's a stretch to call Uganda a fully democratic country. I think that that's not a stretch to say that it's not a fully democratic country. It doesn't identify maybe with the rules-based world order. But there are historic ties in the post-liberation period between African countries and the former USSR and other non-aligned countries or countries from the Eastern Bloc. And these are relationships that are remembered by these people who were in power at the time, who were fighting in the bush in the 70s and the 80s. And they remember the Soviet Union helping them. These are ties that they are not quick to forget. So I think we've crossed the line, honestly, between neutrality and partisanship. Allowing Sergei Lavrov to come to Egypt, the Republic of Congo, Uganda, and Ethiopia is a signal by those countries that they are more than weighing this. They're leaning towards Russia in this conflict. And one can see why historically, because as I said, the Soviet Union and a lot of these post-liberation societies have strong ties. And the U.S. just hasn't been always able to meet them on a lot of these issues. For example, the African National Congress in South Africa needed help and training, and they were a militarized movement. The U.S. was not supportive of them. The Soviet Union, North Korea, and Cuba were. These are important historic ties that we need to not overlook.
Russia's attack on Ukraine and the ensuing grain and food embargo that Russia has created around the Black Sea to prevent Ukrainian grain from going out to many of these African countries. It's responsible for some of the rise in prices in fuel and food, and Lavrov's mission is to try and either paper over these and make sure that these African countries remember who supported them and who supported their efforts in the past. It's going against some of the actual issues that many of the people are facing today as far as whether or not they're getting the food and the fuel that they need for their everyday lives.
Yes, and I also wanted to bring in another angle on the exchange of prisoners between Russia and the United States. Your thoughts on that?
So the U.S. has presented a proposal to Moscow, not just for Brittany Griner, but also for another American detainee, Paul Whelan. And what we're learning is that the detail is that Russia does want Victor Boot, a convicted arms dealer. He was memorialized in a Nicolas Cage movie called Lord of War, I believe. He's that guy who was selling weapons to countries all around the world in the 80s and 90s after the fall of the Soviet Union. He's responsible for countless, countless lives lost in these conflicts. So this is what we might be seeing, this exchange for Victor Boot, for Paul Whelan, and also Brittany Griner.
And it will also be able to be used as criticism against President Biden for cutting a deal with Russia, no matter what happens. If he didn't cut a deal with Russia, he would be criticized. And if he does cut a deal with Russia, he will be criticized. However, he is bringing back, if this deal is consummated, two Americans who have been held in Russian prisons. And that in itself may help him overcome whatever criticism there is.
And I wanted to get on to our last topic. The WHO chief declared monkeypox a public health emergency. What is the White House priority when it comes to monkeypox?
So we heard from the White House COVID coordinator, Dr. Ashish John. I asked him about this earlier this week. So what the U.S. is doing, by the way, right now, is they're working to secure 6.9 million vaccines. Monkeypox has a developed vaccine, unlike COVID. So this is already good news in that, you know, there's an existing vaccine. We don't have to spend time in developing one. And they're also trying to roll out 1.7 million free doses of treatment. We have about 3,000 monkeypox cases in the U.S. right now out of about 16,000 worldwide. So it is definitely a concern. The White House says that they're taking this seriously. It has to be noted that the population that is most affected right now is the community of men who have sex with men. So this makes it to, like, I think the AIDS crisis of the 80s, where the White House did not pay attention to this unfolding crisis because it affected a community that was marginalized.
Anita is right, because the people who are most affected by this so far are men who have sex with men. There is going to be some backlash here in the United States about the U.S. government going to great lengths to try and deal with this situation with monkeypox. When those doses of monkeypox vaccine will arrive and be distributed is still yet to be seen. They're produced by a small pharmaceutical firm in Denmark. Whether or not mass production of vaccines are able to be produced on a mass basis is still yet to be seen.
And I did ask a top health official from Johns Hopkins University, you know, should you wear a condom then if you're going to engage in sexual activity? And he, of course, said, like the good doctor he is, you should always wear a condom when you engage in sexual activity with a new partner. And I said, yeah, that's good advice. But in this case, it just has to be said that you can still get monkeypox even if you take those precautions, because monkeypox is spread through close contact, kind of like Ebola, right? Through any contact with any sort of emissions from the human body. So you can get it from cuddling, from kissing, from touching. So you could get it in a childcare setting, for example. And that is the concern, that this could spread beyond this community right now and go to other communities where, you know, there is a lot of physical contact.
And I want to find out right now what is weighing on your mind this week. And Anita, we'll start with you.
So I love babies and children. I am that lady. I will always hold your baby. And one of the joys of being the Africa correspondent was that children are plentiful and everywhere in African society. People bring them everywhere. And one of my favorite things was just being on the ground reporting in Africa and seeing all of these adorable children and babies and talking to the children and learning from them. And so what weighs on my mind is a 7-month-old baby who I met on Tuesday at Donald Trump's speech. Cute as a button, adorable squishy thighs, you know, the classic baby look. This kid could have been the Gerber baby. And she was wearing an Ultra MAGA onesie and sitting in the front rows while the president spoke. Her caretakers, I believe she was with two aunts, they told me that she was extremely well behaved during Trump's 90-minute speech, which is a great credit to a 7-month-old baby for sitting through anything for 90 minutes. But it just struck me that this baby didn't understand what was being said up there, but she already has a position. She already has a worldview that's influenced by Trump, and I just can't stop thinking about what the future holds for her.
That's a very interesting thought. And Steve, what's weighing on your mind this week?
I've been thinking more about the people who've been caught in the middle, whether they're Ukrainians dodging indiscriminate missile attacks from Russia, Afghans who are trying to make it through each day under a repressive government, hardworking people around the world, here in the United States and everywhere else, who are trying to make a better life for their families while being economically squeezed by high food and gas prices. Their suffering and their efforts every day to just make it through the day and provide for their families is something that I've been thinking about more often than not over the past week. And it's concerning. And it's my hope that things can move better as we move forward through this year for everybody who are squeezed by these various different things that are out of their control.
Very good. And we'll have to close the show on your thoughts. My thanks to our panelists, VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA executive producer Steve Reddish. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to visit us at voaafrica.com for all of our VOA current affairs shows. And thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.